All right. Well, thanks to our presenters. What a great session. Great questions, a lot of them. So we'll get our other presenters up and jump right in. So a lot of questions about combination. Started out, would you combine apremilast with biologics? But then other questions came in about other combinations of JAKs biologics and biologics biologics. So let me run the whole panel. We'll start with Dr. Armstrong. Combinations.
Yes, so we actually do that quite a bit in derm. Typically biologic plus biologic combinations, but biologic plus an oral medication. And so in the distant past, it's been biologic plus methotrexate. And then since apremilast came along, it has been biologic plus apremilast to get the skin efficacy up a little bit higher, with preservation of the safety profile. And then so the newer combinations that we're seeing, if it's approved or approvable, is biologic plus, for example, deucravacitinib. And what we find is that in those patients where targeted therapy of one particular cytokine is not as successful, that having something slightly more broad-acting, such as a TYK2 inhibitor, can help tremendously with a skin disease.
So I think we're learning a lot about combination therapy, and we will learn more soon. There's one trial in psoriatic arthritis doing combination biologic therapy that's combining guselkumab and golimumab and testing that as an induction therapy kind of approach that followed by maintenance, kind of that cancer phenotype or pathway. And that comes from the VEGA trial in ulcerative colitis, in which they utilized golimumab and guselkumab versus golimumab alone versus guselkumab alone, and found that actually there was better clinical outcomes and no increase in safety risk for that combination therapy. So I think we're learning a lot about combination therapy from a biologic standpoint for those really aggressive disease, or those patients with really aggressive disease. In terms of apremilast plus a biologic, I think we do that all the time now. It's just the problem is getting it covered by insurance. So hopefully one is only for the psoriasis and one is only for the psoriatic arthritis and prescribed by two different doctors. And then you're often safe, at least for now. Or if you have a patient that goes back and forth to Asia, sometimes they bring it back with them. So there's a bunch of different ways to do that. I think then the other question is JAK plus a biologic. That one is the one that makes me a little uncomfortable. And that's the only one where I've had some more serious infections when combined. But I think we're getting more comfortable with the idea, and there's some more data out there that's kind of coming in. So hopefully the next couple of years we'll know more.
Okay. Leahy, what's your experience?
Yeah, so same as my colleagues, we kind of use a lot of apremilast and a biologic, and more recently Ducra and mostly IL-23 inhibitors. As mentioned, the main issue, I work in Canada, so the main issue is coverage, and the way around it was to find a dermatologist that feel comfortable, and we prescribe one for the skin and one for the joint, and that's why we go around it. But I think this is something that is also need to be discussed with the patients. I think it's important to highlight the potential safety issues, and at this point, we don't have a lot of data, so this conversation needs to be made carefully with the patients so that they understand their potential risks.
Yeah, it's certainly an important area, one that we weren't able to discuss for so many years because of those negative combination studies in RA many years back. But especially, as mentioned, the VEGA study was really phenomenal. And I think it opened the discussion back up again. So I'll ask all of you, but start with Dr. Ogdi, because you mentioned weight. So a question came in, should we be doing the prior authorizations for semaglutide and tirzepatide? Should we be taking that on since it's so important for our PSA patients?
I have some very nice endocrinology colleagues that will do that. So I think we do enough prior authorizations as it is, but so I think that I don't know that I feel comfortable prescribing it yet. I refer them because I don't know the ins and outs of the medication. So I think that I'm not ready to do that yet.
Okay. April, what do you do with your fat patients?
That we don't call
that. That since they read our notes now. So I would say mostly education. I also do not prescribe those medications. I completely agree with Dr. Ogdi. There is literature in the psoriasis literature showing that weight reduction with hypocaloric diet can be helpful for reducing psoriasis, but that's very restrictive diets, you know, so things like 800 to, you know, 1500 calories per day, probably just what we ate during our breakfast already. So I think weight reduction is helpful, mostly education, but not prescription at this time.
But yeah, I mean, I haven't done the prior authorizations either, but I certainly had people come in and they've lost a lot of weight and they are much better. Leahy, what's the experience up in Canada?
Well, we've been doing a diet study, so it's it's been hard to recruit patients. Alexis and I have been working on it for 3 years now, so I imagine that it would be much easier. But surprisingly, patients don't lose a lot of weight, but there is certainly some people that report a significant improvement just with the diet modification, so I think we'll learn more. Obesity is a major factor. It's been shown a lot more in PSA than in RA, both also for psoriasis. So I think it makes sense. But the issue at this point is how to get access, at least again, at least in Canada, we just cannot prescribe it. It's not even available for us.
Which is kind of a shame, because the data with those drugs now are not just showing weight loss, but cardiovascular outcome prevention. These are serious medications that can really help the patients. It's a shame.
I think one of the tough things is side effect management for some of them. So they get a lot of nausea, for example. And then also they gain the weight back when they stop the medicine. So that's one thing that I don't know that people figure, I don't know how to manage yet.
Dr. Kabalwe.
Yeah, fabulous session. My question is specifically to Dr. Eder about the sex and gender differences observed in the phenotype. And you showed some very compelling evidence that about the processing of pain from Jeff Mogul and others in animal models anyway, that the pain is processed differently. And then you showed some interesting data about differences in the response to various agents. My question to you, and you can just speculate freely as you see fit, do you think that difference in response is related to differences in the biology of psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, or are the agents having a different effect on the pain processing?
Yeah, I've been wondering. I can only speculate, as you mentioned. It's there's been a lot of discussion about the JAK inhibitor and whether they are able to control pain better than the monoclonal antibodies, possibly because of being able to penetrate the blood-brain barrier and influence central pain sensitization that might be more important in female patients. So, I mean, this is a potential mechanism. What I found really, reassuring to make this claim that there might be differences in response between males and females is that we see the same phenomenon across all three JAK TYK2 inhibitors that we evaluated. Both of them showed absolutely no response in males and females. So I think the pain part is mechanism is part of it. I mentioned also potentially development of autoantibodies, maybe another common mechanism to the monoclonal antibodies might be more common in female patients. Some literature in IBD about that, but again, not a lot in our own diseases between development of antibodies in males and females. And then the weight is another issue, because female patients tend to have a slightly higher BMI, and there is more fat, and there are differences, and I'm not a pharmacologist, but there are differences in pharmacokinetics. So that these are potentially three mechanisms. There might be more, and I do hope that with the SAGE study we'll be able to gain some more insights.
Yeah, I mean, this is relevant not just to psoriatic arthritis. You know, a lot of other things that we treat with different mechanisms of action, and if they're actually having different effects on the pain processing, I think that we need to learn a lot about that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, and a follow-up to that, Leahy, in your paper, you noted that the studies reporting sex are all the more recent ones, so hopefully people are paying attention to this much more. What else would you do, would you say, should we stratify We stratify by methotrexate use, yes, no. We stratify by biologics, yes, no, prior. Should we stratify by sex going in these studies going forward?
So I've seen that, like, in new trials are starting. There, as far as I know, I can't remember exactly which one, but the pharma companies are starting to consider stratifying by sex, even just to balance out the differences at the beginning, so to make sure that there is, you know, because if women are starting, female patients are starting at a higher level, it's much harder for them to then reach a minimal disease activity state. So if you look at an absolute target, they have a longer way to go. So that's one aspect. The other aspect that I think is really critical for us to, as a medical community, is to expect the pharmaceutical companies to report these sex disaggregated data, especially for safety outcomes. Because, you know, I know that most trials are not powered to show a difference, but we can do meta-analysis and learn more and then do dedicated research regarding that. So,
since a lot of the differences were related to pain and pain perception, could that be stratified going into the study?
Well, I think sex or gender encompass a lot. It's not just the pain. There are many other things. So I think if you stratify by sex, you have maybe better chances of trying to address this. And you do need dedicated research, I believe, to explore these different mechanisms.
Okay. Dr. Kirsch.
So, Alexis, in the nice review of the different guidelines and the approach, you know, the new thing I think in the last few years is the identification of different domains of disease that need to be paid attention to. But how does that help me as a practitioner? Should I be? I'm lucky. I'm in Dallas. I got a lot of great dermatologists who can do strong medical dermatology. They often manage the arthritis, and likewise, I often manage the skin. But from the guideline standpoint, what should we be going for? Co-management or mono-management?
That's a great question. I think it could go either way. If the dermatologist is seeing a patient with mild psoriatic arthritis and is responding to whatever drugs they're prescribing, then I don't think we know that in rheumatology we have limited resources just like they do. So across the hall from us in dermatology at Penn, we kind of have a set of rules. Like if one is worse than the other, then the rheumatologist manages it from the psoriatic arthritis perspective, and I just call over to derm and see if I need any additional input, and vice versa. So if the psoriatic arthritis is really mild or mostly quiescent, then they'll take care of everything. The problem is the ones in the middle, and also for diagnosis. So, for example, yesterday I had a patient come in on an IL-17 inhibitor, and she said, my skin is getting so much worse again. And it was more eczematous, but she and her local rheumatologist assumed it was psoriasis. And so that's where the dermatologist is needed. I need them to help me confirm the diagnosis that it's eczema, and then think about a next therapy switch for that patient. So, and then if the skin isn't responding to one of our drugs, but the joints have done great, that's again where the dermatologist partner can be really helpful for us.
Okay. A number of questions on the IL-17. There are several of them now. What about differences between them? And what about if someone has done not so well on one, would you go to another? And what about when the insurance says you should switch from one to the other for non-medical reasons? Now, start off with Dr. Armstrong.
Yes, so when we look at our IL-17s, I think from my perspective, there are differentiating things from the skin perspective. Maybe not so differentiating, I would say, from the joint perspective. So we have secukinumab, ixekizumab, bimekizumab, and we also have brodalumab. So when you look at the efficacy of those, there are head-to-head studies now between, for example, secukinumab and bimekizumab in the skin, where bimekizumab is superior. So we kind of laid that question to rest. So in the head-to-head, like a bona fide head-to-head fashion. But when you, so I would say from the skin perspective, now secukinumab efficacy is here, and then we have, you know, eking out where the number one places is ixekizumab, brodalumab, and bimekizumab kind of as a cohort above secukinumab in terms of the skin. In terms of the switching, there are some data in skin that actually switching from one IL-17 inhibitor to another, you actually get different responses. And partly maybe due to the mechanism of action. For example, with brodalumab, it's actually a receptor inhibitor. So it not only inhibits the signaling of ANF, but also a number of other IL-17 inhibitors. So in treatment-resistant patients, for example, for skin disease with other IL-17 inhibitors who have failed ICSI, failed secukinumab, there are some data suggests brodalumab may be helpful. And when you look at the bimekizumab trials, I talked about the head-to-head study, but there are also, even in the parent trials, there are patients who have experience with other IL-17s. In fact, about half of them of the biologic experience actually had other IL-17s have performed well on bimekizumab. So there are differentiating things, I think, from the skin perspective, perhaps a bit more so than the joint perspective.
Yeah, so Dr. Ogji, Dr. Ader, we don't have the head-to-head studies. So what do you all think? And I guess the specific question was, if the insurance says, nope, yeah, we're not going to cover that one, we're going to cover this one, do we push back?
Yeah, so I think we have comparison studies with adalimumab, secukinumab, and ixekizumab where they look identical to adalimumab. And then there's a comparator arm in the bimekizumab study that looks like it's identical too. So I think we have a sense that they're probably all the same from a joint perspective. And the brodalumab versus placebo also looks very similar to the other ones. So this, the non-medical switching, I really don't like switching a patient who's done well on secukinumab to ixekizumab without a break, you know, or, you know, knowing that they're not doing well on it. You can have a patient who's doing well, they've kind of stopped doing well, and then you switch them and then they do better again. But the non-medical switching, I really don't like, but my boss could also tell you that I don't like when people try to make me do things that I don't want to do. So I think that, you know, in general, I try to really push hard for not switching.
Lihid?
I agree. I mean, we are fortunately are not forced to switch, so other than to biosimilars recently. But, I mean, I would agree patients that are doing well, I would try not to switch them.
Changes from the IL-17 inhibitors to the TNF inhibitors. It's an argument we've been having for a long time. Is your anything different with that, Leah? Are you happy? Because there's not head-to-head studies necessarily.
No, I mean, for the joints, we know that they work about the same for the joints. I'll be giving a talk tomorrow about enthesitis, which maybe we can talk more about the data there, which is less consistent than the joint component. So I think doing some more studies on other domains of PSA besides the skin, of course, and the axial disease where we have more clearance would be important as another way to inform us in terms of selection.
Okay. A number of questions on kind of individual aspects of it. And the upvoting, the winner, actually, the number one question, approach to dactylitis predominant disease in psoriatic arthritis. Alexis, what do you think?
So actually, when a patient has dactylitis, I want to get them on a therapy that's going to be really good for their peripheral arthritis because they tend to, you know, respond very similarly. I am going to be more aggressive with their therapy because dactylitis is a sign of more aggressive disease and they can get damaged fairly quickly. So I want to get them on a biologic, for example, or a JAK inhibitor pretty quickly. But the other thing is I start NSAIDs right away, like the high-dose NSAIDs or, you know, like naproxen 500 BID for 2 weeks or so, trying to get that inflammation down. It's a place where low-dose glucocorticoids could help too, but NSAIDs can be really effective for both enthesitis and dactylitis when really active.
Lee, you're going to talk about enthesitis tomorrow, but any particular one? If you say dactylitis, is there any particular therapy that comes to mind?
Again, not in terms of selection. I would also mention injections, local corticosteroid injection. And in particular, I love ultrasound, as you know, and I think it's an important tool, especially when you inject into tendons. I think it's quite useful. In dactylitis, you see sometimes very severe tenosynovitis, and placing the needle in the tendon sheath is something that is a lot easier when you have an ultrasound in your hand.
Okay. Dr. Armstrong, choice of therapy for palmoplantar pustulosis, and there was a separate issue about the TNF-related or TNF inhibitor-induced psoriasis. What about those? Do you have a go-to?
Sure. So when we're looking at palmar plantar pustulosis, which is a relatively rare condition, not to be confused with palmar plantar psoriasis, which they all sound super similar, but the palmar plantar pustulosis is where you get these pustules on the palmar surfaces. Typically, they have it in the soles as well. So typically, the treatment of choice would be, for example, IL-23 inhibitors such as guselkumab or risankizumab. Both have undergone randomized control studies and approved in Japan for that. For IL-17 inhibitor, brodalumab has also undergone randomized trials and is also approved in Japan for that. It doesn't mean the other biologics don't work. It just means currently that's where we have the most data for palmar plantar pustulosis. For TNF therapy-induced psoriasis, so that is a great question. Few things. One is these days we have more therapies to switch to. So, for example, if IL-17 can be more appropriate, one can switch to that. I think in the former years, maybe where our therapy choices are a bit more limited, switching to another TNF inhibitor actually has shown to work actually for a majority of those patients. There's some overlap. There's no guarantee, but I think this day and age, if they must need the TNF inhibitor, typically we treat it topically, see if we can help treat the psoriasis that's induced by the TNF inhibitor. But if the psoriasis is a bit more extensive, we recommend switching, if possible, to an IL-17 or IL-23 inhibitor.
Okay. Following up for the little bit left over from the first pod, what about somebody with moderate severe disease, but they're at high cardiovascular risk? Do you choose a TNF inhibitor over a 23 or a 17 inhibitor, given that there's more evidence showing TNF inhibitors lowering cardiovascular risk? What do you think, Alexis?
No, so I think the main goal is treat their disease. So get their psoriasis burden down, get the joint inflammation down. So I would select the best therapy for that. So I wouldn't necessarily select an NSAID in that particular case if they're high risk for cardiovascular disease, but something that's going to bring the inflammation down. I think while we have data on one set of therapies, it's observational, and we have data from other therapies that in the psoriasis world that they do decrease the amount of PET inflammation there. So I think there's a lot to learn in this area, and we're never going to have all the answers, but treat the disease.
I agree with that. The literature has been a bit mixed in psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis on that. I think that we are trying to study more the effect of IL-17 inhibitors on some of the cardiovascular parameters, but I think literature on that is limited as well. And if you look at some of the RCTs that's been done looking at, for example, aortic inflammation from the Dr. Gelfin and Dr. Ogdi's group out of UPenn, some of the endpoints, you know, it wasn't clear cut that there's a benefit in terms of the hard endpoint. So I think when we select therapies, I completely agree with Dr. Ogdi. I would select it based on its efficacy and safety for PSA or for psoriasis, and would not use that as a primary consideration.
Okay, you knew this was going to come up, and it's going to go right to Dr. Ader. Transgender. How does that impact where would those persons fit in the spectrum of data that you had presented?
The answer is that we don't know. I mean, I know it's a hot topic, but in reality, at least in my practice, I can tell you that when we designed the SAGE study, SAGE PSA study, our ethics was asking, okay, what about transgender patients? And I went back and looked at my practice out of we have 500 PSA patients registered in my clinic. I have one patient who is transgender. So the answer is that we don't know. I mean, there are lots of considerations, and considering sex hormones is something that comes to mind. And again, it's hard to study because just they are not as prevalent in our practice, even in Toronto, which is a very liberal city and is out there. So.
And heterogeneous, which always makes it hard to study. Dr. Armstrong, quite a number of questions on nail, your choice for nail, what to do with the nail, and also one is if the nail is totally obliterated, does that influence what your choice of the go-to medicines for approaching nail psoriasis?
So I'll answer the first part, then the second part. So in terms of the nail disease, there has been a number of network meta-analysis that's been done. Overall, IL-17 class has shown to be highly effective in nail disease. IL-23 class also works well too, but most of the results of the network meta-analysis have shown, for example, ixekizumab is ranked the number one in terms of some of the network meta-analysis that has been done. In the head-to-head for generalized psoriasis between bimekizumab and secukinumab, there are numeric differences showing better response in terms of bimekizumab, but not statistically significant. So I think overall, things that have greater efficacy in skin typically have pretty good response in nail as well. Our IL-23 inhibitors, the response is good as well, but may take just a teeny bit longer in terms of the nail response. Deucravacitinib works in nail as well, but from my interpretation, likely not as well as some of our IL-17 inhibitors. What to do if nail is obliterated? Typically, if it's only psoriatic nail disease alone, it would be very, very rare for the nail matrix to be completely destroyed because it's typically in non-scarring nail disease. So if it's psoriatic nail disease, in vast majority of the cases, if we can put patient on a therapy that's effective for psoriatic nail disease, that their nail will grow. Things that are scarring, for example, for nail, I would be concerned about things such as, lichen planus, which, have more cases of scarring than others. And if that were the case, JAK inhibitors, in case report forms have been shown to be effective for treating, those type of nail disease.
Great. Alexis, will there be new PSA guidelines from the ACR next year?
I think next year would be optimistic, but sometime soon.
Okay. For the whole panel, patients with psoriatic arthritis have bowel symptoms but a negative colonoscopy. Would you use an IL-17 inhibitor if they failed a TNF inhibitor? And we'll start with Dr. Ader. I haven't picked on her lately.
Well, if they have bowel symptoms, then I would send them to see a gastroenterologist. And if it's ruled out, then I would treat them with IL-17. I don't think there is any indication to withhold this treatment if there is no evidence of colitis.
Yeah, I think there's actually good data that our poor gastroenterology colleagues, they have as hard a time telling IBD from IBS. The Crohn's disease activity index is based on number of bowel movements, bloody or not, response to narcotics, et cetera, and it doesn't differentiate. So they have IBS that you can't tell IBS from IBD just by asking the patient.
I will say that when I have a patient with IBS, I am a little bit more concerned about starting an IL-17 because some of that becomes IBD sometimes, or you're like, oh, actually, that was Crohn's a while ago. But if there's any group that I would be maybe more hesitant in besides the IBD patient, it's the IBS patient.
Yeah. Do you, any of you, I know there's that very interesting study from NYU where they looked at the MRE and tried to look at the SI joint and the lumbar spine. I've tried to get that. And our radiologists, they say this is not the right sequence to look at the bone. So you can't double dip. Have you had any positive experience with it?
I mean, I guess same thing. Most of the time when I call to ask, they say, no, we can't really see that. It's the ones that they pick up and they say, oh, actually, there's some sacroiliitis there. So it kind of goes the reverse way.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then, of course, then you have MRE, you have video capsule endoscopy, in addition to the colonoscopy. So it's a number of questions on enthesitis, but that's going to be covered tomorrow. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. Always a tricky one. What do you do with a patient who develops melanoma during anti-TNF treatment? And this is good for all of us because it's a psoriatic or disease, arthritis or just skin psoriasis or both.
Yes. In general, currently, based on our recommendation, is to stop the biologic therapy if the melanoma is beyond stage one. If it's stage one, so meaning that it's limited to the skin, then it's a case-by-case basis. The reason being that oftentimes there are subsequent workup for melanoma that may involve sentinel lymph node biopsy or the addition of, for example, immune checkpoint inhibitors. So I would say that have a discussion with the oncologist is very important. But typically, if it's skin limited, in general, wide excision, take out the melanoma if the patient doesn't need a sentinel lymph node biopsy, and then making sure that patient understands that the biologic therapy may or may not change their course of recurrence and that they consent to that is very important.
Anything different? We certainly see people develop, or other kinds of cancer, when they get the diagnosis of cancer. Anything different that you all would do?
I sadly have had about 3 of those patients recently, and so, you know, 2 of them have really bad disease. One of them we stopped the therapy for. That patient was on an IV therapy, and their psoriatic arthritis and psoriasis have gotten so much worse that it's making his quality of life horrible. And so we're going back on again, even though it was stopped out of an abundance of caution. The reverse, you know, in a patient who I know is going to flare really badly because she always does poorly off therapy, we've just continued it and, you know, documented the consent to do that and work with the oncologist to say, let us know when we need to stop it, and there'll be times when we will hold it.
And of course, for melanoma, one of the treatment options are checkpoint inhibitors,
yeah,
which drive all our diseases crazy. So I don't know. I'd love to see what we all find. I think the oncologist is very different one from the other. Just for me locally, the GU oncologists are perfectly happy with whatever we want to give them, whereas some of the other oncologists, like for renal cell, they don't want TNF inhibitors. Mm-hmm. What has your experience been with people who are on checkpoint inhibitors?
Yeah, I think, you know, some oncologists are pretty particular. What I have seen is that they are in general, oftentimes I will suggest apremilast, to them. In general, they are, pretty amenable to apremilast. They get a little bit nervous with the TNF inhibitors, in my experience.
Great. All right. What an incredible session. Thank you very much to our panelists. So for our virtual audience, you all have a showcase that's going to start in just a few minutes. It's Dr. Hillary Norton talking about TNF incomplete responder patients with psoriatic arthritis and what to do with them. For our live audience here, we have lunch, and please do visit the exhibits as well. And we got a lot still this afternoon. So the third pod is JAK inhibitors across diseases, and that'll start sharp at 1:30, and we have a couple more things to go still before we get to the distilled. So go get lunch and come on back, and we'll see y'all.
Thank you for listening to this reprise session from Room Now Live 2024. This session and these recordings were sponsored by AbbVie, UCB, and Amgen. Be sure to register for Room Now Live 2025 when you can have full access to all the videos, all the recordings, all the downloads, and all the board questions that come out of Room Now Live 2025.